Hey, drama listeners, welcome to year three of drama. Connor and I could not be more excited for all of the upcoming interviews, conversations, and just amazing surprises that we have in store. If you want to continue helping us keep the ball rolling and churning out great content, we would greatly appreciate your support on our Patreon, which we affectionately call Patreon. You've heard us talk about it before, but it's basically bonus episodes, access to our Instagram close friends, and also the eternal love and gratitude from Connor and I. Who could ask for anything more? This holiday season, we would absolutely appreciate if you're feeling a little giving, if you would help support us at just $5 a month. You don't even realize it's such a small amount compared to what else, you might be budgeting for. So thank you, thank you, thank you. We love you all, and get ready for a very, very fun episode coming in your ears right now.
Press play, curtain up, and now we're in. It's time to take spin.
The shade and tea to spill.
Ooh, drama. Oh, that's a tweet. Did they book? Who got nom?
They option no.
Oh, I'm not well.
What star will we talk to today? Oh, that's a gag, honey.
Say no more. Drama.
Drama. Welcome to Drama, a podcast that covers theater,
pop culture,
love,
and life.
Hey, Dylan.
Hey, I am still getting used to our new intro that we've been doing for literally 2 years. We've cut in New York City and the world from our intro.
In year one, it was in New York City. And then in year two, we famously had a pandemic and expanded to interviewing people around the world. And now it's just everywhere. So,
well, if we were to say it today, it would be in New York City, where you are. Columbus, Ohio, where I am, and then Salt Lake City, where our guests are. And speaking of Salt Lake City, we have some things to discuss about the Real Housewives of Salt Lake City.
I know, because Dylan, we are in between weeks here of a landmark moment in Housewives in reality TV history.
I'll never forget where I was when I watched that episode.
Oh my God. Well, for our listeners, Jen Shah, who's famously a Real Housewife in Salt Lake City, who I actually met at a Halloween party 3 weeks ago, and I told her that I was a big fan of the show and kind of like creatively didn't tell her I'm a fan, but everyone was DMing me like, oh my God, you met Jen. And I was like, my night with a convict.
Literally. Well, she's been indicted.
And the episode where they're at Beauty Lab and Laser in the van getting ready to go, which we all saw in the teaser trailer for the season, but holy shit, Dylan, it was everything.
I know. The look on her face when she got the phone call that was alerting her that the feds were on their way to arrest her and lock her up raw.
Not raw.
The way that her expression dropped, the shock on her face, you could feel it. My heart was thumping.
I know.
And she was then on the lam, fully ran away.
They broke it down in such like a true crime way. I felt like I was watching a murder mystery. Like you saw what Heather was doing. And then when they're sitting in the van and Jen was gone, and you could see the feds through the windows of the van. And like we as viewers, I mean, we knew it was coming, but it was haunting. It was a true horror movie.
And I can't wait for part two. I hope it delivers.
I know. Wait, I was gagged for Whitney putting the pieces together in the van. Like, oh shit, it's going down and it's not Sharif in the hospital. There's tea.
I think that Jenny was living for every second of it. She was like, wait, they're asking about Jen.
Oh my
God. It was great. And Heather Gay, she's returned to my top queen of Salt Lake. She lost me for a minute, but now she's back.
Agreed. And Lisa is delivering. I wish Meredith was in the van, though, because she really delivered on that episode when that guy from Mary's congregation came through.
Oof.
And she was in such
shock. She put in the work.
Wait, did you hear that guy is like actually deceased now? Like in real life?
No.
Yes.
Oh, that's troubling.
I know. And there's no cause of death listed on his online obituary. I'm not even kidding. You can't make this stuff
up. So you're saying that Mary M. Cosby had him taken out. Okay, listen. We want to get to our guests today who they've gone on their own walking tour of the Real Housewives of Salt Lake City while they're in town. Perhaps they're busy working on new musical.
I know.
Who knows?
I don't think they've had time, Dylan. But listen, this is an historic moment in podcast recording history, because we've only ever had one other duo on the pod.
So on the main pod,
this feels like a party. I am so excited, and I'm just gonna bring them in because the time is now. All right, drama listeners are in for a special treat today as we come at ya with a duo for the second time ever. Our first guest made history as the first Asian-American woman to play Christine Daae in Phantom of the Opera on Broadway, as well as performed as Cosette in Les Miserables and in The King and I on The Great Bright Way. Other credits include the national tour of West Side Story as Maria, The Fantastic, 1776, Chicago at the Muni as Mary Sunshine, and more. Our second guest is known for his work in Gold Mountain for many of its iterations, Miss Saigon, Thoroughly Modern Millie, Sweeney Todd, and more. He's the co-writer and star of the acclaimed musical web series City of Dreams. Together, our guests are the stars of the world premiere of the new musical Gold Mountain with Utah Shakespeare Festival running through November 20th. The show's creative team is entirely comprised of women and artists of color. That is a gag, honey. Say no more. Please welcome to drama, Allie Ewald and Johnny Lee Jr.
Hi.
What an intro. Thank you. Thanks for having
us.
Yeah,
seriously.
It is so fun to have you both here. Welcome to drama.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Are you well?
Yeah, I can't speak for Johnny, but you know, we are at the end of our second day off in a row, or I guess we had 2 days off and we're going back into week two of performances of Gold Mountain. So I feel delightful, refreshed, really.
You know, I woke up from a 2-hour nap just 30 minutes ago. It felt great to sleep. So yeah, I'm ready.
Johnny, was it like a nap though, where you woke up and you were like, what day is it?
It was like one of those food coma naps. I ate my lunch and I was like, I'm gonna go sleep now.
That's me after any time I eat a Jimmy John's sandwich, and I don't know if it's a Jimmy John's thing.
It could be, you know, I love Jimmy John's and I usually get their unwich.
Me
so
too.
I usually feel okay.
I'm such a whore for the unwich.
Oh my God.
It's so good.
See, I love the bread.
Wait, so how's the food in Utah? Is that a thing anyone's ever wondered?
It's a very valid question. So we are performing just outside of Salt Lake in West Valley City, which I'm told, and please listeners correct me if I'm wrong, is one of the most diverse places in all of Utah. And it means that we are surrounded by delicious Asian food, like all sorts of like really, really yummy Asian food. In fact, I had a delicious Thai lunch today from one of the local places. Thank you, Tuk Tuks. Shout out to them.
A little pad Thai, a little pad siu or something like that.
Indeed. We literally have had Vietnamese food maybe like almost every other day. I've had several bowls of pho. They've all been very delicious.
I'm hungry.
I know. It's so here's a little secret, because I'm guessing that neither of you have worked on, you know, a predominantly Asian show before. But one of the most magical things about doing a show with a very Asian company is the amount of food that is constantly either talked about or being eaten or shared at the theater. I mean, we've got snacks galore for days that have come from the Asian grocery store. Every rehearsal ends with like a full length discussion about where the next meal will be. It's very central to the process, I would say.
Oh my God, I love it. What is it like working with a cast, and is it a crew too comprised of all Asian people?
It's honestly wonderful because, you know, whenever we do a show that's predominantly Asian American or has a lot of Asian American people working on it, it's kind of just like a family reunion. You know, our community is not terribly large, and we either know of people or are really good friends with people already. So whenever something like this happens, it's just kind of like a little bit of a party.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's something kind of, I've been able to do, you know, I've been fortunate to do shows that have had predominantly Asian American casts and ones that haven't. And I think that exactly as Johnny said, there is just this built-in level of sort of comfort and family, because if we don't know each other already, we know a million and a half people in common. And so we have all of that common ground. And it's also really remarkable. I was thinking about this when I did The King and I on Broadway, that, you know, most of our sort of family cultures are actually incredibly different, right? My mom grew up in the Philippines, which is very different from Johnny's family in Taiwan, which is different from our cast members who have family in Japan. But there's something that's really connective about the Asian American theater community. And one of those things is food, honestly, but also just this, like this great respect and celebration of, you know, what we've all been able to accomplish in this business. I think because it is a smaller community, we find that being supportive of each other and really uplifting all of our work is incredibly critical to kind of survival and to continuing to make great, great art. And so this process in particular, because we've had a creative team, you know, Alan Marocca, our director of like Sesame Street fame. We had Amanda Morton as our music supervisor, who I never worked with before, but had, you know, heard amazing things. And she was so wonderful. And Joanna Lee is our conductor. Jason Ma obviously wrote the entire show. Billy Bustamante and Darren Lee on team choreography. It's just been really exciting to have all of these really, really talented, hardworking AAPI artists getting to be in charge and help us create, you know, create this art together.
Oh my goodness, so beautifully said. And your ability to recall all the names, I'm literally blown away. Was Billy Bustamante in Miss Saigon on Broadway?
He was. Yes. He was assistant commissar.
He was.
Okay. I knew the last name there. I remember there was this article written by Louis Peitzman a few years ago. I don't know if it was in Playbill or something else, but it was about Asian representation on Broadway and how small it has been in Broadway's history. I mean, I could probably name on one, maybe two hands, the number of predominantly Asian shows. And so I think it's really exciting that we're getting another one right now, Gold Mountain, which has obviously been gestating for years. I'm really excited to learn more about the show and hopefully more than just the lucky, you said it's called West Valley View or?
West Valley City. Yes.
West Valley City. Hopefully, you know, that's that area and Salt Lake and beyond, we'll get to experience a little bit about the show. I'm curious just about like, what is the story of Gold Mountain?
Okay. So Gold Mountain is predominantly about, so everyone knows that we built the Transcontinental Railroad, right, across the country. And a lot of the times, you know, a lot of people aren't aware, but a lot of the western half of the railroad tracks were built by Chinese immigrants. And so Gold Mountain is about a group of Chinese immigrant men at a certain campsite. And along with that comes a young man who becomes the fuse runner. And a fuse runner is someone that pretty much, because the bosses were really cheap and decided that they didn't want to spend too much money on the Chinese workers, they had a man go into the cave, light a fuse and run out before it would explode. So, you know, she'd save on cost instead of buying long fuse. And so it's about him. And then he meets a beautiful young Chinese prostitute. And they have a torrid affair.
Oh my God, this sounds like drama.
There is definitely drama. There's plenty of drama. And what's amazing is, you know, all of this, obviously, like we're telling a fictional story, but it's all based on historical fact, including, you know, all the people that came over. And Johnny and I got to do a reading of this about 2 years ago here in Utah. We were both in Salt Lake City and in Ogden. And and we were brought in. It was the 150th anniversary of the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad. It's called 150. And it's the first time that the descendants of the Chinese railroad workers were included in these celebrations, and that the contributions of all of these immigrants, these people that built the railroads that we use today, you know, that were actually being honored and included in the American narrative. I think more often than not, the Chinese workers have sort of been written out of the story of the creation of this country. And so our musical was brought in as, you know, as part of celebration and telling the very human stories of these people that, you know, that existed and were not treated well or paid well or, you know, but were integral to the infrastructure of this country.
Wow. That is like the power of theater and even film and whatnot, that they're able to highlight these stories that maybe haven't always had, you know, this might not even be in anyone's history book in America. You know, it's interesting to me. I mean, I can also imagine a lot of people probably did not survive this, especially the fuse runners probably.
Yeah, they indeed died.
Indeed. Major plot point.
That's a big plot point.
Yes. And, you know, like the one of the biggest points that the creative team wanted to make sure that we depicted was how rough it was to be in this area, especially during the winter when it was just so freezing cold and there was really nowhere to go. And there are times where the railroad workers would have to live inside the mountain and continue working while everybody else had a winter break.
Wow.
Okay, wait. So, Johnny, do you play the fuse runner?
I do.
Oh. That fuse runner sounds like it could be an alternate title, but maybe I'm just thinking of the science fiction book, The Maze Runner.
He does get a whole song describing what his job does.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my God. Is that like his I Want song?
No. My I Want song is about falling in love with a girl in China. Just like my dream of having a family, because it's very, very Chinese to just want to marry, have children, and build a family for yourself.
Wow. Okay, so then Allie, your character, what is she doing? Would they hire sex workers to come and visit them while they were working?
Well, they did, not for the Chinese workers, unfortunately, but for many of the other, the railroad bosses and the people that were working around. So a lot of, before there were a lot of women, you know, in California during the gold rush and the building of the railroad and all of that, more often than not, you know, the men that were there would frequent some brothels and they would have women brought in. So that was for a long time sort of what was happening. And my character story is that she grew up in China. Her family comes upon really hard times. And I actually ended up doing some research and some of it said that at that time, because of famine and drought and all sorts of other things, and sort of the importance of male children versus female children, about 1 in 10 girls were given away or sold to help support their families, not necessarily into prostitution, but, you know, as indentured servants or as wives or, you know, any of those things. And so that is kind of the trajectory of my character. May kind of decides to take care of her family because they've fallen upon really, really challenging times. And, you know, probably unbeknownst to her, has to endure quite a bit of hardship over in California. But in the circumstance of our play, finds this camp that is filled with Chinese workers who speak her language, who understand her culture, who have a connection to home, to Chinese opera, to all of these things. And that really brings her to the campsite. It's been really interesting because both Johnny and I have been working on this musical for a long time in readings. And I've discovered how little, you know, when you're doing a reading, you're concentrating so much on making sure you get words out and you know the notes that you're singing, and because you aren't super familiar with the text, that you kind of miss some things. And I realized, I was telling Johnny in our process, that one of the lines in the show is that the brothel that my character is based in is an hour away from the campsite, which means that every time I choose to go visit Johnny's character, I have to trek for an hour through like the mountains and the desert. But it is that important for her to be able to be with somebody who understands her needs and wants. Obviously, there's love connection there as well. And that is, those are the stakes for her, you know, that it's worth getting to spend some time with people that understand and love her, to trek for an hour each way for like, what do we meet for, Johnny? Like 15 minutes maybe?
Yeah, literally for like, oh, it's just 5 minutes of like sweet flirting. And she's like, bye.
So is there maybe some jealousy though from other men in the camp who might be interested in May?
So no, actually, it is a plot point that a lot of the men feel shame when they see her, because they bring up a lot of insecurities about how they have left their women behind at home, their children, their wives, and they're also disrespect for the profession that she's in.
Okay, I don't want to give away too many plot points because I do feel like there's going to be a future for this.
I want to see it. I'm like literally obsessed. It sounds so good.
Allie sing, her first song in the show is like literally, it's a epic song that I get to sit on stage and watch her do every single night. And it's like, it's honestly one of the most magical journeys I've seen in a musical theater performance. It's beautifully sung, obviously, but it's also just so heart-wrenching. And like within those, like what, like 4 minutes or something? It's like, I don't know. I'm just lucky that I get to watch it every single night.
Johnny's being very kind. And also like he's missing the point that he is totally integral to the whole thing, because I have to keep, you know, referencing back to him. And he is in fact my scene partner as I go on this epic journey from which I usually pass out right about.
Oh my goodness. Have you two been attached to the project for most of its life?
Yeah, I think Jason decided that we've each missed one of the iterations of like the readings, but it's been, I think almost, what, 8 or 9 years, something like that. It's been a long time that I've been working on this for sure.
Yeah. Wow. I think you've been attached for that long. I've only been attached for, I think, around 5 or 6 years, I want to say.
What an interesting experience.
Johnny, what is the music like? I'm kind of curious.
Oh my goodness. So Jason Ma, the writer, has written this beautiful, it's just very sweeping and gorgeous and very traditional musical theater, I want to say, because he wrote this piece sort of in the height of the big operatic musical theater style with all the camera MacDosh productions about. So it kind of fits in that world. I don't know. It has wonderful musical motifs that are very Chinese, but then has some beautiful Western musical theater influences as well. It's a really great combination of both.
The imagery in it is just kind of sweeping and takes you away in the best way, in the way that musical theater can kind of bring you out of yourself.
It's definitely poetic.
I need to see it. I need to come. I'm coming to Utah. I'm just kidding.
Yes, please.
Well, hey, I hope that there's a life for it. I was thinking about you guys talking about how long you've been involved in it. What a gratifying experience it probably is to get to spend so much time on a piece and then to finally put it out there for people to see it, you know? Oh my gosh.
Totally, totally. Actually, the journey from beginning to this point has been over 20 years, obviously, because of, you know, when Jason had wrote the piece. But even from when I started, the first time I actually even ever acted with Allie was we were lucky enough to do a workshop in Saratoga Springs sponsored by the Maisie Center, Elliot Maisie, who's a wonderful producer that has done a lot of producing for Broadway shows. He decided to do a workshop up at his center. And what we did was, before Zoom was even a thing, we acted with each other through this weird four-screened movable computer thingy. I don't know what it was, but Allie was in New York, I was in Saratoga Springs, and we would just act with each other through it. And even from that moment, I was like, oh, this is really fun, this is really special. And it was exhilarating to be doing something like that so new, especially with Allie, and I hadn't even met her in person yet at that point. It was crazy.
Elliot Maisie's been very, very far ahead of the curve with the he actually made his business doing e-learning. He's been teaching people for many decades, and so now he's like, oh, this Zoom thing, it's old hat. But he brought us in before we knew what was happening.
Is he still involved with the production?
Yeah, he was here this weekend. He came out to see us and support, and I believe he's taking the train all the way home to New York so he can experience, you know, this thing that these Chinese workers helped to build, you know, and what it would be like to travel by train from Utah all the way home.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that is so cool. Wow. Okay, wait. So I there's other things I want to talk about with you guys, but I just have to say congrats on this run. I hope that everyone, even if they don't get a chance to see it, I hope that there is more life to it, because it sounds like a story that needs to be told, and I need to see you both do it. So it's got to live on.
Or maybe we'll get a cast album. Broadway Records loves to do that. So
yes, we'll all of the things. All of the things should happen. Hey. Oh, and just one other little thing, to go from, like, you know, what John is describing, our little Zoom thing, to get to walk into the theater here and see this beautiful set. We're in sort of the most thrust, but the tunnel that Johnny's character, the Fuse Runner, goes into, we have this beautiful green bluff.
When we first saw the space as a whole in the thrust, they're just the magic of theater, right? Just immerses you within that world, and seeing all these things finally realized was an other out of body experience. And also, like, part of the joy was seeing Jason Ma witness all of this stuff. You know, he would sit in the corner and just basically, I would see a tear fall out of his eyes. I'm just like, oh my God, literally the things that you've dreamt about are coming into life in real material. And it's just, it's a feeling that I bet you can't even just reproduce anywhere, you know?
Oh yeah, especially, you said it's been 20 years. Like, the Cameron McIntosh era was like late 80s mega musicals, like early 90s. So this has definitely been like probably a dream for him.
Oh, totally. And it was a really tough road, because when he wrote it initially, he submitted it to every place. And he got really awful rejection letters, where people would be like, why do you think musical theater even needs to hear this story? You know, like stuff like that, which was very upsetting, I could imagine. And it really brought him down. Yeah. So he basically shoved the musical under his bed for 20 years.
Wow.
What was it that inspired it to come back out of hibernation?
It was Allie. So he saw Allie perform, I can't remember where it was, but I don't think he had known her then, but he saw her perform at this concert, got to meet her, and thought, I have this perfect role for her. And honestly, she is stunning playing this role. It's so good. And, you know, he had the right instinct, because he saw her in it. She is basically perfect for it. So he decided to revive his musical theater aspirations as a writer and producer, and has sought out basically every opportunity till now.
That is so cool. She was his muse.
She really was. And she's like the most wonderful muse too, because not only is she super talented, but even the rehearsal process, just her instinct with the character and understanding of it all, just really brought forth beautiful, beautiful rewrites that make sense. And especially in the time that we are in right now, you know, because like, you know, a lot of the things that we have to watch out for is if something was written years and years ago, it doesn't really apply to our current cultural lens sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There was also all these conversations that were happening about all of these crimes against elderly Asian people and rallying for representation and whatnot. And so I think that this is coming at the right time as well, when it's like, well, hey, this show has been in the works.
And to that, what you're saying about the Asian hate crime stuff, you know, part of the reason why that happens is that a lot of American media doesn't really depict Asian Americans or even Asian immigrants as real human people. And I feel like that's why it's so easy for random people to attack elderly people like that, you know, because there's obviously xenophobia happening because of this pandemic that we're all experiencing. And aggression like that just happens to be easiest on the weakest, which would be the oldest of our community. And if entertainment really depicted Asians as real human beings, like this story does, it shows you that we can be multi-layered people instead of just like the nerd or the sexy sex worker on the corner, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear you say that. I was speaking with my friend recently about the TV show Insecure on HBO, which I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's so freaking good, Issa Rae. And my friend was saying to me that, because we were talking about how it's the final season and it's ending, and she was saying that she's especially sad it's ending because as a Black woman, she doesn't see many TV shows or films even where it's about Black people just existing in every part of themselves that they are. And when you were just talking about that, I realized I don't think there's many shows about Asian Americans just existing as they are. You know, I mean, I can think of like two different shows that have been out in the last couple of years that have predominantly Asian casts, but there aren't even that many TV shows that have Asian stars. You know, I mean, it's really upsetting. I remember when, and I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, but on the TV show on the CW, My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Dylan, you watched it, right? The Rachel Bloom show. She made the romantic lead of the show an Asian man. And I remember reading an article about it.
Vincent Rodriguez III.
Yeah. And she was like, I want to show that like Asian men can be sexy too. And they are sexy. You just haven't been shown this yet. And like, this is the guy that I am heartbroken over, that I'm crazy over, you know? And I thought that was so cool. And it was something I had not thought about, you know?
Yeah. I mean, Rachel grew up in a predominantly Asian community because she grew up in Southern California. If she grew up in West Covina, it is literally, like, I don't know, 70% Chinese. So I remember when Vincent did get that part, we were all like, the entire community was super excited for him because, you know, it was his first big break, number one, into TV. But to represent a character that was just literally a bro that was Asian was so different and super exciting to see, right? Because you don't ever see that.
I think they called him Hot Josh, right? Wasn't that his name?
I think Hot Josh or just regular Josh, because they called the other one White Josh.
White Josh, right. Yeah, exactly.
Because in real life, a lot of the times we would experience that as being like the Asian one, not the standard normal, quote unquote, normal one.
Oh, jeez.
I think really brings it home to all of us how special this is, how important it is for this story to be told and for different voices to get their chance to, you know, to really have their ideas and dreams and thoughts realized. It's so impactful.
Wow. Well, we have just been chit-chatting away, but we do want to get to one of our favorite segments that we have on the show that I'll let Connor describe because he loves to intro this segment.
Dylan, you know me too well. We call it the Ringing of Keys moment, inspired by Fun Home, where we ask our guests about that moment of recognition where they realized they loved the arts, the theater, television, film, the entertainment at large. And either of you can start, but did you have that moment when you were like, oh my God, I need this in my life?
Allie first.
Oh gosh. I mean, there's so many moments. I'm gonna go with when I'm totally dating myself, but when I watched the reboot of the Mickey Mouse Club before Britney Spears was on it, there is this amazing actor singer named Dee Dee Magno Hall, and she is Filipina. And I remember sitting in my living room when we had like the free trial of the Disney Channel and watching her sing and dance and be beautiful and be really cool and be like part of the whole fabric of the Mickey Mouse Club and think like, wait, she's Filipino. I'm Filipino. That means that I can possibly do this too. And the crazy full circle moment of it all is that my very first professional job out of college, I understudied Dee Dee. In the Aladdin show in California at Disneyland, I was her understudy / flying body double. I got to ride on the magic carpet while Dee Dee was downstage, like singing A Whole New World. And I shared a dressing room with her and Jenny Kwan, who was also, I also got to watch on television when I was a child, another Filipino American who was on the show called California Dreams, again, totally dating myself, but I got to understudy those two women and they were the kindest, loveliest, most talented people. They sat with me for my put-in, helped me pin curl my hair, told me where to put my microphone. They didn't have to do any of that. And they just, not only had I idolized them as a child and they, you know, they inspired me to join the business, but then they really taught me how I wanted to be, you know, if I was ever fortunate enough to be a leading lady, to be leading a show, you know, the way one behaves with kindness and grace.
Oh my goodness. And you know, wonderful. Funnily enough, about a year ago, we had Dee Dee on Drama. She's a friend of the pod and
I love her.
She, yeah. I see a lot of the similar qualities between the two of you, just so generous and kind and very, very positive. I mean, she finds joy in everything. And I think it's so cool that you see someone on TV and you're like, I literally want to be them. And then one day you're literally them as their body double.
So crazy. And thank you. I mean, that is the highest of compliments. And it's funny because I feel like since Dee Dee's been living in LA and mm-hmm. now she's actually in Vegas, we haven't gotten to see each other face-to-face a ton. Like we see each other on social media. And earlier this summer, I was doing a concert with Broadway Barkada, this amazing Filipino-American group in Vegas, and Dee Dee came to support. And I had been like talking about her in venues like this so much, but not really getting to say thank you to her face. And I came off the stage and she was crying and I was crying. We had just this like beautiful love and hug fest. And I just think the world of her. She's amazing. Oh my God,
that's so special. That is so special. We got to see her as Nessa Rose in Wicked on tour. Like that was like our introduction to her with her husband as Fiero.
Beautiful couple.
Yeah, shout out to Clifton. Clifton's awesome. Yeah, yep.
Beautiful couple, beautiful family. Well, Allie, I love your Ring of Keys moment. I think it's so special. I love when the Ring of Keys comes back around and is full circle. Johnny, what do you have anything that's top of your mind as your Ring of Keys?
I do. And it's actually oddly, it parallels Allie's in a little bit. So in the way that for some reason Asian women have affected us. So when I was very, very little, my high school did a production of Sound of Music and the lead was played by a Chinese American woman. And it was my first exposure to literal just like stage musical theater. Cause before that I watched like movie musicals and such. So I remember seeing this girl sing Maria and in my head I was like, oh, she's Asian and she's able to play this part. That's really cool. But I didn't really think I could also do that as well. But then when I was around, I think, I can't remember what age, but I became obsessed with Les Mis and I really wanted to see Les Mis. And I told my parents, they're like, sure, we'll go see that. And then they bought tickets to Miss Saigon. And I was like, what the fuck? So then we went to go see Miss Saigon and I sat there and I was like, I don't want to see this, but then all these beautiful Asian bodies came out on stage and one of them was Dee Dee Magno Hall. She was the first Kim that I ever saw. And I just remember sitting there being amazed by everything on stage and just like the beautiful sound coming out of her, number one, but the emotional journey I took just watching that show at such a young age too. Well, at first I was super embarrassed because I was with my parents and everyone was like super scantily clad and I was like, nah, why am I here? But then the drama kicked in and then I saw the story and it was just beautiful and it made me think maybe I could do this too.
And you did.
Yeah, I did.
You were in Miss Saigon,
and
right?
I did a small touring production to Saigon that started out in Kansas City that did a couple of other cities after that. But I also was able to perform with Dee Dee in a couple of galas for East West Players out in Los Angeles when I first moved out there. And that was a really wonderful moment because, you know, just getting to work with someone that you saw on stage and really just affected your life that way, it's magical, honestly.
I love that so much. I'm like kind of laughing, but I'm like obsessed with the fact that this podcast is about Dee Dee. She'd be like, what are you talking about? Like, this is crazy. But no, it's really amazing. And it's been said forever and ever, but representation obviously matters. And you know what I mean? Like, Johnny, you being like, maybe I could do that. That's so powerful. It's inspiring to me.
I want to kind of cherry pick one credit each for both of you before we kind of wrap up. But Allie, we have to talk about Phantom.
Yes.
Are you tired of talking about Phantom? Are you so sick of it?
Not at all. Never.
You, of course, made history, and now we have history being made again with the first Black Christine alternate. Yes. But I want to know, just what was that experience like doing Phantom on Broadway for you?
You know, it was crazy because it was such a long journey. I was literally auditioning for some iteration of that show for about a decade before I finally booked it, literally. And so something about that, like the fact that I'd had all this experience under my belt, that I had been, you know, not cast in the show so many times, I think in a lot of ways was a gift in that I was able to really appreciate it for what it was and to know that I had kind of the skills and the experience to step up and handle that kind of a role. And, you know, and that kind of pressure, I think there was a lot. I was the first non-white Christine on Broadway ever. And I joined in its like 29th year. So, you know, Margaret Ann Gates did the show in Canada. She's amazing. She was also like an Asian Ellen in Miss Saigon, but she never gotten to do it on Broadway. And so at that point, nobody had done it in London. Nobody had done it on Broadway. And so that was a lot of definitely self-imposed as well. Pressure of like, okay, if I'm going to be the first, A, like, you know, why did I get chosen for this honor, but B, like, I need to make sure that I'm not the last one, right? That the door doesn't close behind me, that it doesn't affect the show in a negative way. And so I'm just really grateful that I was in the right kind of headspace, I think, to be able to handle that. And then again, like, I have to shout out to our amazing Asian American community, because the amount of excitement and support that I got from all of our wonderful people and people that I had looked up to, you know, that like Anne Harada and Jason Ma and all, you know, like just all of these really, really remarkable performers. Leia Salonga came to see me a couple of times, like, and who understood that it was significant and were really there for me and supporting me on that journey. And I think that that's part of what made it so special to get to do. I mean, it was a selfish dream role. I've always been a soprano. And it's like, well, that's the part for me. So.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And that show is a machine. Was Hal Prince still alive when you were a part of it?
He was. Yeah, he was at my final callback. He sat in the fifth row and gave me some notes, and he came to my put-in. I got to have a meeting in his office, and I was really fortunate. I came in. I had Hal that I got to work with. Jillian Lynn was still around. She came to some of my early rehearsals before she passed away. And then we had rehearsals with Andrew Lloyd Webber came in, Cameron McIntosh came too. I was there for the 30th anniversary, so they were all present for that. And so I was really fortunate to get to work with everyone. And now I'm so excited. I can't wait to see. I haven't seen Emily on yet. Emily is the first Black Christine on Broadway. And I'm just so thrilled. I got to hang out with her in the theater. We were both doing an event at the Majestic about this amazing documentary that Sammy Canold made, The Show Must Go On, which hopefully will be able to be viewed at some point. But Emily and I met there and got to take some pictures with Sierra, and I got to show her around the dressing room. And I'm so thrilled for her. I hear she's doing amazing things over there.
Iconic Christines left and right. That is a gag.
For sure. I'm so sad I didn't see you in Phantom. I've actually never seen it on Broadway. Isn't that wild?
It's not. I mean, honestly, it's not unusual. I had a lot of friends who had never seen it on Broadway because there's usually never any urgency. There's so many other shows to see. And, you know, Phantom is kind of that given of like, oh, there'll be time. I'll go see it later. So I totally understand.
Wait, Johnny, tell me about City of Dreams.
Oh, okay. So City of Dreams was a web series that me and a couple friends decided to write when we were just kind of out of work and doing literally nothing. We ended up writing this pretty, in my opinion, pretty hilarious, like little show about three basically liars living in New York City. They lie to all their friends that they're, you know, in production of this beautiful, epic new musical that Cameron McIntosh was interested in. And basically they had to make good on that lie and find ways to trick everyone to believe that they were actually successful.
Wait, wow, is it available for viewing?
Yeah, it's all on YouTube. It's I think it's 11 episodes, so you can literally marathon it. It takes 2 hours. And super silly, we have some really lovely Broadway stars on the show as guest stars in certain episodes. We have Stephen Arenas randomly was in it because we have a mutual friend, and he was a big supporter of us while we were doing that. And we got Billy Porter literally right after he won his Tony too.
Oh, wow.
So he was so busy, but so generous with his time and was just such a joy.
Oh my goodness. And I think I saw like, it was critically acclaimed. Like, didn't the New York Times even have some nice things to say?
Yeah, so randomly when we first released the first episode, USA Today put it up and we didn't even ask them to. They really enjoyed it and just did that. And we had an article, we were included in this article about different Broadway-based web series in the New York Times, and Playbill also featured us as well.
Oh my gosh, congrats. That's so cool. Do you have any other ideas tinkering around in your head for other web series or...
I mean, definitely. We, on the side, besides acting, I'm also doing a bunch of writing. And during the pandemic, actually, most of my time was spent writing pilots and such and pitching them to networks and all that sorts. Unfortunately, I didn't get anything, but, you know, it's just building that network, climbing ladder, you know?
Oh, that's exciting. Oh, my God. The sky is the limit for both of you.
I know. You guys are amazing. But before we go, we do like to end on a dose of drama to share the drama in our hearts and on our minds. Dylan, do you have a dose of drama today? I could kick it off.
I do have a dose of drama, but go for it.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, by the time this comes out, this will have passed. But the original Broadway cast of Spring Awakening is doing a reunion benefit, and I didn't get a ticket, unfortunately. And I feel extremely dramatic about it because Spring Awakening was so impactful to me as a young, you know, middle school student / high school. And I can't believe they're just doing one night. Like, come on. They could have done like every Monday in November and sold it out, right? I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. I'm curious if they're going to like, I had heard tea that they were going to actually do scenes from it, not just sing the songs. So I'm interested to see how it all turns out, and hopefully there's some coverage online. But the drama of the ticket prices being insane, you know. But what are you going to do? It's
something we all said that was going to change after the pandemic. LOL.
Yeah, that's my real dose of drama. It's like everyone's like, we're going to make theater more accessible, and we're going to make it more equitable, and we're going to make it more affordable, and they've. Basically, no one's done that. So that is drama. But anyway, Dylan, I should say Broadway shows have not done that.
Yes.
Theaters across America, I can guarantee you are. And I know that Matt Ross has tried to make specifically like Dana Agent, Is This a Room? And Passover more affordable and giving cool options to see those plays. But other than that, it is still crazy. Anyway, Dylan, dose of drama to you.
This dose of drama is, it's just top of mind because Andrew Lloyd Webber was mentioned, but I heard recently that plans have been scrapped for this Glenn Close Sunset Boulevard movie adaptation. And I am devastated because what? This is, yeah, isn't that crazy? It's been circling the drain for years and it's just not going to be happening unless something, you know, I don't know. I can't believe that there wouldn't be like someone who's like, hey, we need to make sure this happens.
I'm super upset right now.
She needs her Oscar.
She does.
Johnny's gonna riot.
I am. I'm like legitimately mad.
I know. You'd be great in Sunset. Both of you. As Betty and what's his name?
Joe?
Yeah, Joe. Yeah. We need an all Johnny. Asian production. And Harada can be Norma Desmond.
Oh my god. Yes. And Harada should do everything. All the time.
Oh, that voice on any of those songs would be amazing.
I her belt is just unreal. I listen to The More You Love Someone all the time.
It's so unexpectedly brassy, right?
I know. When they did that Bombshell in concert, she sang I Never Met a Wolf Who Didn't Love to Howl, whatever that song is called. And she nailed it, knocked it out of the park.
Johnny, do you have a dose of drama?
I don't know. Well, I guess I'll just piggyback on some of the stuff you said. With Spring Awakening, I do want to say that I grew up in the town next to Lea Michele. And I was supposed to do a production of Cinderella with her when we were in high school. She was Cinderella and I was the prince. And we rehearsed for 1 week, but then she quit, sadly.
Really?
She had been on Broadway at that point. And I think, you know, I can't say for real the reasons why she quit because, you know, I was having fun with her. And but I think there might have been some issues with her agency and her doing a youth production somewhere and like them not being super happy with her just doing like free work somewhere.
She would say in interviews that it was really hard for her to go from Broadway to doing her community, like community theater work because she was a member of Equity. So maybe that was why. Maybe it was true, Johnny.
I've never thought about that with child, or, you know, minors who are actors about, you know, like say the kids in Fun Home, were they allowed to go back to their hometowns and just do community theater? I don't know.
I feel like the rules are unclear with that because, you know, if it is community theater and nobody's getting paid for it, I doubt Equity would really do anything about that unless there was like some money involved, you know, but I could be wrong. I mean, I've never done a community theater production after I turned Equity, so I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Well, that is so fun that you knew young Lea Michele. I'm literally gagged and have many questions we'll talk about later. Allie, do you have any dose of drama for us today?
Oh my goodness. Well, it's funny because I was going to talk about, you know, how sad I am that I finished all four seasons of The Great Pottery Throwdown. And now I don't know what I'm going to do with my life. But now, which is true, which is absolutely true.
I heard it's amazing.
Drama.
It's so good. It's so, I mean, pottery is dramatic. I had no idea. You never know what's going to come out of that kiln. You don't know what's going to come out of the drying room. There are like cracks galore. There's all sorts of like innuendo and like pulling like the handles. It's very,
Those
of you who haven't watched it, highly recommend. But now I feel like I have to throw in my Lea Michele story, which is not like super drama actually, except for me. Which is that I was auditioning for the revival of Les Miserables, where I ended up playing Cosette. And I came in for my final callback. I was in between tour cities of Les Mis. I was in between Cleveland and Cincinnati. And they had me come in for a final callback where I was like matching up with Marius's and Eponine's. And Lea Michele was there because she was auditioning for Eponine. She ended up doing Spring Awakening instead. But on my way to my callback, a bird pooped all over me, all very much all over me.
Oh my
God.
And
so I was in the bathroom getting ready for the audition with Lea Michele picking out like just bird nonsense
that
smelled very bad out of my hair. And in some ways it was actually the best icebreaker to meet all of these people, including, you know, Cameron McIntosh and John Carradine and all of them. Be like, I'm so sorry. A bird just pooped on me.
Right.
Here I am.
But that was good luck.
It was good luck.
Indeed. Yeah. It worked out. I booked the show. It worked out well.
Oh my God. Wait, who ended up playing Marius and Eponine? I'm curious.
It was Adam Jacobs who was there, and he and I had done the tour together, another Filipino American.
They were beautiful together.
Oh, thank you. And we had sort of a leg up because we already had done the show. And Celia Keenan Bolger was my Eponine first, and then Megan McGinnis replaced her later. So excellent, awesome people.
And we had Aaron Lazar on the pod, and he was in that production as well.
He was indeed.
Norm Lewis. What a diverse, I don't want to say reimagining, but just, I mean, Daphne Ruben Vega.
So many hotties. Oh my God.
Yeah, Daphne was our Fontaine, and then Leia Salonga came in and replaced her. So it was really cool thing to get to be part of.
So cool. Well, I love that we also made this about Dee Dee and about Lea Michele. You know, you never know what's going to happen on drama.
Wait, I have a burning question for Johnny. I know we're like keeping you guys forever. You were obsessed with Les Mis when you were young and your parents took you to see Miss Saigon, but did you ever get to see Les Mis?
Oh, most definitely. I saw the original 3-hour plus production. It made my like year, honestly. It was amazing. It was like probably, I saw it, I think maybe 3 or 4 months after I saw Saigon.
Wow.
I think I complained.
I needed
enough.
That closure.
Yeah, I did see it.
That's amazing. Awesome. Well, You two are so sweet and so fun, and this has been a true delight to have you on the podcast. I am devastated that I can't go see you in Gold Mountain right now, but I wish you both all the success, and I hope that the show has life beyond this, because it is a story that deserves to be told.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both for having us.
Oh, yeah. Now, you both are on Instagram for sure, right? It's just your names.
Yes.
Yes.
And we'll include those links in the description below. Are either of you on Twitter?
Yes.
Yeah, but I don't really use it.
Vaguely? Okay. That's probably safe, honestly. Well, listen, I hope that we can meet in person one day and talk all things Broadway and life and Dee Dee Magno Hall. I am a fan of both of you, and I am so thankful that you spent today with us. For those of you who don't follow us yet at The Drama Podcast, get on that and follow Connor at Connor McDowell and me at Dylan McDowell. And Connor, I will see you next time.
Drama.